From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the Texas-Mexico border is seeing a human wave of children from Central America. Texas moves to privatize a big part of the foster care program, but will it make the troubled system any safer for the children? And is Texas ready to move to online voter registration? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Tens of thousands of children are turning up at the Texas-Mexico border. These unaccompanied minors are fleeing a humanitarian crisis in Central America, and most of them are being apprehended by the U.S. Border Patrol. The massive number of children has overwhelmed the detention facilities and forced Homeland Security to open a temporary shelter at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio. It's estimated that Lackland is holding over 1,000 of these children, some of them as young as 3 years old. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees has been studying the problem and recently released a report called Children on the Run, Unaccompanied Children Leaving Central America and Mexico, and the Need for International Protection. Nicole Boehner is a protection associate for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
Well, we're really talking about what is a humanitarian crisis. And the migration of these children, many of whom are coming to the U.S., is really a symptom of this crisis. And so for this year, U.S. government authorities have projected upwards of 60,000 unaccompanied children, so that's a child without parent or legal or guardian with them, coming to the U.S. to seek protection. Basically a ninefold increase in the numbers of these kids from the Northern Triangle region of Central America, which is Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras.
So these are countries that are right now highly destabilized.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on there?
Well, what we've seen through talking with the children themselves, earlier this year UNHCR released our report, Children on the Run, where we interviewed over 400 of these children. What we heard directly from them are increased violence. The violence from gangs and other organized armed criminal groups, while always a chronic problem, has really been escalating in the past few years. And these children, who are typically the most vulnerable members of society, are not just accidental victims, but even targeted victims of these groups' threats and violence.
Are they victims of sexual exploitation?
Yes, they can be. When we interviewed many of the girls for our report, they shared with us just horrifying stories of being abused and taken advantage of by gangs, sort of forcibly recruited as girlfriends of gang members, with incredible sexual violence as a potential consequence. And many of the boys talked about being forcibly recruited into the gangs and being targeted on their way, walking to school, that being an easy way to find them and harass them.
These children, and what ages are we talking about?
We are talking about, so when we say children, so anybody up to just shy of 18, but the U.S. has seen children as young as even babies coming to the U.S. Now, obviously, they're not coming on their own, but many children coming under the age of 10. They're getting younger as this phenomenon continues, and even seeing more and more girls as part of the population that's coming.
A 10-year-old, for example, that's not out of the question, would be...
No, not at all.
Would be basically a refugee fleeing their country in Central America and somehow getting all the way through Mexico and ending up on the U.S.-Mexico border.
Mm-hmm.
How do they do that?
Well, so many hire the services of smugglers to facilitate the travel. Also, many children do it on their own. Hitchhike, they ride on top of trains going through Mexico, which there are many reports of the incredible dangers of that journey. Others take buses. There are stories of children who walk incredibly long distances, all the ways in which you can think of children have taken that route to come north.
Even at 10 years old, though, and when you're a 10-year-old, do you even have the faculties to know that I want to leave my country and I want to cross through Mexico and somehow get to the United States?
No, it's a very good question. And some of these children travel in groups or with older siblings or friends. You know, while we are talking about the young kids in particular, still the majority of the children who are coming are teenagers, you know, 16, 17 years old.
But do they have the idea, is it somehow conveyed to them that if they get to United States that they can declare asylum, they will be given some sort of safe haven, that they won't be deported back to their home countries?
What we found in our study with the children was that no, most of them, the vast majority, only very few, had any idea of what to expect in the United States from our immigration system. Really, it was stories of the dangers that they were fleeing or the chronic poverty or their hopes for the future, but they weren't necessarily stories of, you know, hope tied to any specific relief available in the U.S., but more an ambiguous hope for a better life. You know, these kids are incredibly, you know, they're diverse. They're not just a uniform group. And some express their reasons for why they left as an expression of what they're trying to leave behind. And others really are more forward-looking and talked about what they were hoping for. And yet, you know, those kids could have had essentially the same story, but they view their situation differently. All these children, you know, there was incredible voices of fear, hope, and always courage, as you can imagine, to undertake such a journey and make such a drastic decision. Children making a drastic decision, it's really shocking.
Well, they're likely to be apprehended by the Border Patrol. Then they're going to be put into a deportation facility and sent back to where they came from.
So the children are put into removal proceedings where they do have to go to court in order to fight for their right to stay in the United States if they do have a means available to them. The children are put into a system of shelters that are specifically for unaccompanied children. And so they're put into protective custody where services are available to them and their safety can be ensured. And so they're not immediately removed from that situation, but the decision of the immigration court, you know, is what determines whether they're able to stay or have to be returned.
Nicole Boehner is a protection associate for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. They released a report called Children on the Run about the tens of thousands of unaccompanied children leaving Central America and what's driving them towards the United States. For years, the Texas foster care system has been plagued with inadequate outcomes and even a high number of children dying while in state custody. The state legislature has tried a number of reforms and fixes and is now moving towards privatization of the oversight of child protective services. But child advocates are critical of this makeover, saying other states have tried similar efforts and ended up with lackluster results. Emily DePrang reports on this new take on this old challenge facing the Texas foster care system. She's a staff writer for the Texas Observer.
Texas has had many fatalities of children that were in state's custody, children that have been removed from their homes because they were in danger and then who died either of neglect or abuse while they were in state care. Actually, over the last 5 years, one in 20 children in Texas who died of abuse or neglect died while in state custody. That's not all of those were their caretakers harming them. Some died of injuries sustained while they were with the families they were removed from, but some did not. Some died at the hands of their caretakers. There have been several years in a row of having between 8 and 14 children die in the foster care system.
Some of the reporting on this has looked critically at the case levels for the CPS workers and about the turnover of the CPS workers. What is the situation there?
Texas has a longstanding problem keeping and training and hiring up enough caseworkers to keep the levels, their caseloads reasonable and low enough to where they can do a good job of making sure the kid is safe in a family. The legislators recently added some money with a goal of trying to get caseloads down from about 33 down to 28.4, but that's still almost twice as many as experts recommend for the safety of a child in foster care. Turnover is also a major problem. They have about 25% turnover last year, they reported, of caseworkers who are more than half of caseworkers have been on the job for 3 years or less. So that means they're spending, you know, maybe 8 months training, and then they have this pretty short period of time in which they gain experience, and then they leave the job, and then they have both vacancies that increase other people's caseloads, and then the child doesn't have consistency. There's not somebody that knows the child or knows the family. People are constantly coming in fresh, and kids that I talked to talked about just this cycle of faces that they never get to know, and they would see their caseworker maybe 10 minutes a month. They're required by federal law to see each of their charges once a month, which many kids say they didn't even see that.
So we know that the foster care system has a lot of issues and problems and challenges. The state legislature has been looking at trying to reform it with privatization. What are the offerings of privatization? Why are they moving towards that?
Well, it's the main thing that privatization usually offers or is supposed to offer, which is expertise, where the state is supposed to be sort of farming these responsibilities out to people who do this for profit and therefore have figured out the best way to do it. And then, of course, savings. Texas has never come out and said that they want to save money by bringing in more privatization to the system that's already partially privatized. But they did decide that they wanted to improve all of these different metrics for kids, which includes placing siblings together, moving kids fewer times, things like this. They wanted to do better at those goals, but they didn't want to add any more money to the foster care system, and so they brought in these I call them to myself regional overlords, because they're these large child placing agencies that are supposed to oversee smaller child placing agencies and use the same money that the state was spending to try to get better outcomes. And so the idea is that they'll be able to do a better job, but the problem is that no state that's privatized their foster care system has ever seen better outcomes financially or in terms of these kinds of metrics that you can look at and try to numerically understand what a child's experience is.
So how does the privatization actually work? Because it's still state employees who are the CPS workers, the caseworkers.
Right, that's true. And that's true for now. Actually, back when there was a rash of deaths in 2004 and in 2005, the legislature it was so important to reform the system. Privatizing casework was one of the things that they wanted to do. And there was huge pushback from that. Because the system is already partially privatized. So when a child comes into the system, they're usually sort of handed over to a private child placing agency. So these are agencies large and small that are responsible for recruiting the foster parents and training them, and they have all of these responsibilities having to do with oversight. So caseworkers are still legally responsible for the child's welfare. But this extra layer of privatization would be, or is, because they're rolling it out now, is that areas of the state are divvied up and a private company, whether for-profit or nonprofit, bids on it and says, I can run that. I can keep kids placed within this region so that they're closer to home. I can find, you know, I can decrease the number of kids who are sent to institutions as opposed to actual families. You know, I can collaborate with churches and behavioral health places to make sure that kids can get the therapy they need. I can do that for this area. And so the child placing agency becomes an overseer of all of these elements of a child's life, in addition to overseeing all of these smaller child placing agencies under their purview.
But isn't bringing in this private overseer just adding another layer of bureaucracy?
That is exactly what it's doing. It's not privatizing an existing function unless you want to say that the function is sort of oversight and development. But the state, they really push back and say, we're not getting rid of any oversight. We're still going to manage everybody. We're still going to make sure everybody's doing their job, and they're supposed to. But the truth is they're adding a layer of bureaucracy. It's another level between the state and the kids.
So the company we're talking about is Providence Human Services?
That's one of them. Basically, there have been two areas where private providers have been brought in and have taken over responsibilities. And the largest one and the private one is Providence.
But what about transparency? It's important that there is adequate oversight by advocates for the children who are able to see if the instances of abuse, neglect, and exploitation, you know, are reduced.
The thing about this whole process of bringing in this oversight, bringing in these overseers and these private companies and everything, this is all called foster care redesign. And that's the term that they started using after privatization. Calling it privatization became really unpopular. And it's remarkable that the word privatization is now being used with it, because that was kind of verboten for a while. But anyway, it's called foster care redesign. And it's not actually built explicitly around improving child safety. Foster care redesign makes some changes and brings in this company that's supposed to improve outcomes. So it's supposed to make the things that make the normal foster care experience, the standard experience, the things that make those things harder, it's supposed to make better. But one of the metrics that Providence and other companies will be based on is, was everybody free from abuse? And the expectation is that that will be true 100% of the time. I have not seen how any of the changes are directly addressing abuse or the kinds of things that let a child die in state custody. That is not one of the things that gets a lot of focus, or that is obviously safety is a child objective. It's a main and most basic child objective. There's no one working on this that ever wants to see a child harmed. But among advocates and former foster youth, there's a strong belief that the state will not acknowledge what a massive problem child abuse, sexual, physical, and emotional abuse is of foster children, and therefore, how can they fix it? And I haven't seen any way that foster care redesign directly addresses the issue of abuse.
Emily DePrang is a staff writer for the Texas Observer. She is reporting on a state plan to privatize the oversight of the Child Protective Services foster care system, which has been problem-plagued for years with a high rate of child abuse, neglect, sexual exploitation, and even death. You can read the article online at texasobserver.org. In the aftermath of the recent primary runoff, one of the startling bits of information is just how few people actually voted. Under 5% of registered voters took part. And it's been clear for a long time that Texas has a low voter turnout problem. But would online voter registration help change that? Backers of online voter registration says it might, but that's not the main reason for adopting the electronic system. David Becker is the director of the Election Initiatives at the Pew Charitable Trust.
Well, online voter registration isn't a new idea. It's already been implemented in 19 states for about 100 million eligible voters nationwide. And what our research shows is that it's one of those rare win-wins in government. It saves a ton of money by transferring a lot of paper activity to electronic activity, meaning human beings don't need to key in all that data and they make a lot of errors. It's a lot more accurate for that same reason. It leads to greater integrity in the rolls because information can be checked in real time against motor vehicles lists, et cetera. And overall, it's just a tremendously efficient process that both election officials and voters prefer in all the states that have put it into effect so far.
So people need to realize, first off, that voter registration is not online voting. It's very different.
That's right. They're very different things. For online voter registration is like many transactions, like banking transactions and the like, where you're connecting a transaction with a particular individual. So an individual needs to confirm their identity with information only they would have in order for that to take effect. Online voting is very challenging, and most agree that we're not anywhere near ready for it, because you can imagine with our anonymous system of balloting, our secret ballot, you have to be able to separate the ballot itself from the person who had cast it. That's a very difficult thing to do while still maintaining your ability to confirm that the results haven't been tampered with.
Why do we have voter registration anyway?
Well, I mean, so voter registration dates back to the 19th century, and there are a variety of reasons. And one of the valid reasons for voter registration is it helps election administrators plan for the election. It lets them know how many voters might show up at an election. It lets them plan based on what the election is, how many ballots to have printed, for instance, how many machines to have available, how many poll workers, how big the polling place should be, those kinds of things. So it can be a helpful tool. But that being said, it's one of those rare instances now in American society where someone has to go and find a particular paper form from a government agency, fill it out in paper, and hand it to a government official. You just don't see that happening very much anymore. And so in many states, they've been able to move beyond that, much as the way as people are paying their taxes online, paying parking tickets online, et cetera.
What would that entail to register online? It wouldn't be exclusively online. There would still be the paper option?
That's right. There's always a paper option for those who don't have access to online registration or prefer the paper option. But what it would entail is there'd be a website, probably hosted by the Secretary of State. That's the way it is in most states, where a voter inputs information that only they would have, usually their driver's license number, perhaps the last four of their social, perhaps the expiration date on their driver's license, along with some other information. That enables the system to confirm that they are who they say they are. And through that system, they would simply input the same information that might be on a voter registration form to either register for the first time or update an existing registration with an address change, for instance. It's a very simple process, but unlike the current system where all of that paper activity then has to be translated by a human being, the illegible handwriting read, and processed by hand, usually in a very short window of time before a presidential election, this would all be done electronically, saving a ton of staff time and resources when election offices are often most busy, which is right before a big election.
What about the problem with errors in the system that we have now? People show up to go vote. They think they're registered, and then they get there and they find out not all the information is incorrectly, and maybe they have to cast a provisional ballot.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Our research indicates about 1 in 8 voter records is no longer up to date because people have moved, because there have been data entry errors in the system. And the paper system really exacerbates this problem because it leads to these data entry errors. It's very difficult to process information. There's a backlog of information that occurs right before a presidential election. Online registration, when that occurs in a state, the voter themselves is inputting the information. The person who has the most incentive to ensure that the information is accurate and who knows the information best is putting the information directly and giving it to the state. That means the information is going to be much more accurate. And in the states that do it best, they even check that information in real time against motor vehicles data and the voter registration database to see if there's a disparity in the data so that if you accidentally input your birth date wrong, for instance, it would come back to you and say, that's not the birth date we have on file for you. Can you double check that? That's very powerful to be able to do that while the voter is still sitting at their computer rather than when you're looking at a paper form when the voter might be days or weeks away and unable to be reached.
But what about in getting more people to vote? Because Texas does have an issue with not enough participation.
So online registration in and of itself is just a part of that equation. There are a variety of reasons people turn out or don't turn out. And online registration doesn't appear to increase the number of people on the rolls. What it does do is transfer a lot of the paper activity to electronic activity. And since it's so convenient for voters, the chances are that the voter records are going to be more up to date earlier in the process.
But in and of itself, this online voter registration doesn't necessarily mean that more people will register and there will be an increase in election participation.
That's right. The greatest benefit that states have seen from online voter registration is a good governance benefit. It saves money. It creates more accurate lists. It breeds efficiencies in the process that didn't exist before. It creates efficiencies in election offices where they can use their staffs more effectively, which means elections are going to run more smoothly. All of those things are huge net positives, even if there isn't an increase in turnout that you see from it.
So there is a long track record now with people, states doing this, although it's not happening in Texas. It's happening in Arizona and California, Utah. Are we seeing it benefits one type of voter over another?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as you point out, this started in 2002 with Arizona. Washington joined in 2008. They were the only two states then. By 2012, it was 13 states that offer online registration, and now 19, with several more to join this summer. What the data suggests is that those who choose online voter registration look exactly like the existing electorate in a state. It does not benefit one party or one demographic over another. It doesn't even seem to have significant impacts, disparate impacts between young and old voters now at this point. If you look at states like California, 47% of online registrants in 2012 were Democratic, while about 20% were Republicans. Why is that the case? That's because that's exactly what the voter rolls in California look like. They're disproportionately Democratic in California. Whereas if you look at a state like Utah, Republicans accounted for about 49% of all voter registrations, and Democrats only 13% of voter registrations. Again, that's because that's what the voter rolls in Utah look like. And we see that in state after state after state, Arizona, Maryland, Kansas, Louisiana, other states that have online voter registration. It doesn't change what the electorate looks like. It just makes it a lot easier for individual voters to make sure that their voter record is up to date.
Last legislative session, this almost passed. Are you hopeful it could pass this time?
I think a lot of individuals are hopeful. I think the county election officials in Texas are hopeful. Certainly we at Pew are hopeful. We're working with a lot of states right now on online voter registration. It's really gotten to the point that it's so tried and true, and the benefits have so clearly been established that there isn't much opposition to it anymore. There wasn't really even earlier, but there were more questions about the security that have now been conclusively answered. So, given the hearing that occurred in Texas, it's very clear the legislators are addressing this very, very constructively, asking all of the right questions. The election officials, both at the state and local level, are really constructively engaged in this process, as well as other state agencies like DPS. So I think there is hope that this will move forward in Texas in a way that Texas state government and Texans overall will be happy with. And so we're going to look forward to working in Texas in the 2015 legislative session and see what happens.
David Becker is the director of the Election Initiatives at the Pew Charitable Trust. He recently testified before the state legislature about the benefits of online voter registration. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs posted online that you can listen to. And you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.